Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Bring yourself back online.
No one knows what I'm thinking.
Tell us what you think of your world.
This is just a cheap trick.
Some people choose to see the ugliness in this world. The disarray. I choose to see the beauty.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching Westworld. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
If you were just joining us for Still Watching, what Richard and I do every week on this podcast is we pick a television show that we are watching closely, watching obsessively sometimes, and break it down. We do not spoil future episodes of a TV show, even if we have already seen it. So this week we will be discussing season 3, episode 3, The Absence of Fields. We will not be discussing anything in the future, just this episode. This is a Tessa Thompson extravaganza, and that is what we are here to chat about. If you want to send us an email, we love your emails. You can send them to stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. I wanted to start with this email from Marta, because she brings, presumably before she even watched this episode, she brought up something that I noticed in this episode, which is this. Greetings from Portugal. Do you think we can read any symbolism from the colors, black versus white, of the dresses that Dolores and Maeve very prominently use in the real world? It reminded me of the black and white hat from season 1. Is it resetting a good versus evil rhetoric, or am I just reading too much and they're just really cute dresses? So I didn't read too much into Dolores versus Maeve, but in this episode there's some extremely striking shots of Evan Rachel Wood in her blonde head in all black and Tessa Thompson in her dark hair in all white. So that did seem to me to be a very intentional contrast. At its best, Richard, what do you think something like that could mean for the show and for the audience?
Well, I think it's just, I think the simple answer is that it's just like, it's good visual differentiation, you know, like the show deals in a lot of like, kind of a stark palette, you know, and in this kind of future world, everything is very sleek and minimal. And so I think, you know, if we're going to be working in those terms, we're not going to see a lot of bold patterns, you know, and probably not too many bright, you know, jewel tones or anything.
Right.
And it makes sense for Dolores to be in black. She's skulking through the world, you know, trying to do her, you know, sort of subversive things. Whereas the people in white are maybe more like, I mean, at least certainly in terms of Charlotte or sort of Charlotte, more public facing, more front facing, you know, can shine a bit more. I think it makes sense. I think we mentioned this last week when we were talking all about Maeve, as opposed to Dolores. Like, I like that Dolores is kind of set up as this one monolithic ideology that I think we see shift a little bit, but expanded upon a bit in this episode. But her sort of would-be opposition, be it Bernard or Maeve or potentially Charlotte at some point, their motivations are more complicated, and it's not really clear what their kind of end want is. So I don't think that we should really look at this as like a binary. You know, who knows? Because the show has told us the same thing through these same visual cues before. So
yeah, this idea of Dolores sort of taking on the Man in Black role in this episode, or in this season, I think that's more applicable to season two, because season two, she's like this force of destruction sort of tearing her way through the park. In this season, I think it's supposed to be a bit more nuanced. So, yeah, I agree with you. I wouldn't say that it's exactly like good versus evil or anything like that. That being said, well, the other thing, and I think we pointed this out, is most of the people in this futuristic real world do dress, as you say, in like blacks and whites and grays. And in that way, Caleb stands out, because I think at one point he's wearing like a brown suit, and I think we see him in some like blues as well. So like he's standing a little bit in from this like monochromatic future world. So I think that's sort of, it seems like, more what they're going for. That being said, they're definitely trying to do a lot of softening of the Charlotte-esque character in this episode, you know, for better or for worse. So that like, you know, angelic white, or I think she's even wearing like baby pink in some scenes, might be like a very aggressive way to feminize someone, possibly. Not a way that I necessarily agree with, but something that they might do. Okay. So this email comes from Susie. And Susie writes in, "It's interesting that Caleb was shot in the head and in the portion of the brain that programs humans to believe in God." I'm not sure that the show has said exactly where Caleb was shot in the head. So I don't know if Susie's making a slight extrapolation there. But if Caleb is missing that part of his brain, is he suddenly released from a portion of his humanity? Is Caleb going to be able to relate to Dolores slash hosts differently than other humans relate to them? If people have that part of the brain, are they going to somehow transfer their belief in God to a belief in robot gods? Is Rehoboam a god that must be replaced? If Caleb is not able to believe in God slash gods, then is he the perfect human to work with Dolores to overthrow the system? Does Caleb's brain have something hostish in it? Is Westworld going to go further into the idea that humans were created purposefully and with a purpose like hosts? The show spent so much time on the Caleb's brain idea that I think it has to be important in some way to the plot this season. Susie. So I'm actually not sure I agree with Susie that the show spent that much time on his brain. He just says it sort of like someone beat you to it. But in this episode, in episode 3, we do see that unlike most of the humans around him, Caleb has not only doesn't take these like, implant, you know, drug things, but he has everyone, it seems, is fitted with this like retainer like thing on the roof of their mouth that controls their nervous system, and Caleb has his turned off intentionally. So what do you make of that, Richard?
Well, yeah, I think we're just getting to know Caleb and what, you know, his particular wounds are. But he definitely seems to be someone who has been not almost like, I mean, I think he's chosen to opt out of the system in terms of not having his implant on and various other things and like committing these crimes kind of, you know, subversively. But at the same time, I think that there was an inciting event that knocked him out of the system, right?
Right.
That completely challenged his faith in the organization of things, you know. And here we have in this episode all this talk about, like, you know, can you make your own fate, you know, blah blah blah. Is, I'm never gonna say it right, Rehoboam, you know,
Rehoboam, yeah,
Rehoboam, does that represent, you know, God's divine plan, which has always been right. One of the most vexing questions of I would say Christian faith, Judeo-Christian faith, you know, maybe Islam too. I don't know enough about any of these religions to tell you, but one of the most vexing things has been, well, okay, so if God knows everything that's happening, then what's the point of anything, and it's a kind of like circular logic loop. You know, so maybe that's what this show is about. I mean, in the same way that another Lindelof creation. Well, I guess this is not his creation, is it? No, Lindelof isn't involved with this, is he?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, so like, sorry, you and I were talking about Lost before we started recording.
Sorry,
in my head. But in a way that another kind of slick, cool sci-fi show like Lost eventually was kind of about God and heaven and purgatory and stuff like that.
Right.
Like, I wouldn't put it past Nolan and Joy to be like, these are easy tropes to work with, you know, in a way, because they contain a vastness. of stuff. So, I think that what we're seeing, especially in this episode, is setting Caleb up as the imagined us in this world, right?
Right. And he's more human than the other humans around him because he has this thing turned off. I was discussing on the other Westworld podcast that I do, Decoding Westworld, we were discussing the film Gattaca and this idea of Ethan Hawke's character in Gattaca, similarly is sort of like more humans than the other humans around him because he's not, genetically perfect. And this makes him an outsider and part of a lower caste, in this society, but it also makes him, easier for us to relate to as viewers. And so that's sort of like the Caleb role here is he's like, you know, Aaron Paul referred to his character as an everyman. And it's sort of like he can be our entree into the world more so than someone else who's completely dialed into all this technology, who is completely like sort of given himself over. And this idea of like needing to find a God, like you're right, you know, like Lost becomes about religion. All Lindelof shows become about religion and faith in some regard. And so this, this idea that like we humans need something to believe in. This is sort of the idea that Dolores was talking about in episode one, which is like, you guys didn't have a God, so you created your own in like Rehoboam. You created your own master, basically. That we need a master to follow. It's human nature to want to like have, you know, a God / parent to follow. And so like Caleb, adrift, looking for something, refuse, like denying the big brother technological authority, but latching to Dolores. You know what I mean? Like putting Dolores in that position. Mm-hmm. Because as much as he thinks he's like there to overthrow the system, he's just really giving himself over to a different kind of authority, if that makes sense.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
All right. So we're going to talk about this episode a little bit. And then we want to talk about the, I'm going to make Richard talk to me about twists, in film and television. So maybe as we're talking, you, the listener, might be thinking about your favorite twists and what works for you and what doesn't. Cause we're going to talk about that because this whole episode, you know, a big question mark hanging over this season is, who are the robotic lieutenants that Dolores, what are the identity of the robotic lieutenants that Dolores has sent out into the real world to do her bidding? We've got one masquerading as like a, you know, security guy at, Insight, played by Tommy Flanagan. And then we've got this one with, Tessa Thompson's face, looking, impersonating Charlotte Hale. And then we've got, Bernard. Who's his own thing. And so we've got two other mystery hosts out there in the world, if we're doing our math correctly. And the episode has us follow the host posing as Charlotte Hale all the way through the episode without ever telling us who that host is. And to me, that is a frustrating experience. Because one of the big things that happened in season two is that for half of the season, as it turned out, we were watching Tessa Thompson do an Evan Rachel Wood impression. And we didn't get to appreciate it as it was happening because it was part of the big mystery of the season. The big twist of the season was like, whoa, you thought you were watching Charlotte, but you were watching Dolores, bro. So like, but in doing that, it means we could not properly track the emotions of this person as they're giving it to us. So like this Charlotte Hale host is going through something, but we don't have the full context of what she's going through because we don't know where she's starting from, if that makes sense. So Richard, I guess broadly, like how does this Charlotte centric episode work for you?
I mean, it's nice to see Tessa Thompson kind of put, you know, really front and center in an episode, considering, you know, a season and change ago, people were wondering why she was on the show to begin with, and, you know, she wasn't getting enough to do. So, like, here we have, like, you know, her star profile has risen considerably since she first signed on to the show, and so they want to, you know, obviously, like, they have her on contract, they want to put her to good use. But again, like you said, like, that use is muddled because, yet again, we have, you know, we have a scene where she strangles the would-be, you know, molester of her, of Charlotte's child, and she says, I'm beginning to like feel more like myself or something like that, and it's like, but who is that, you know? And right. Like I guess I'm assuming we're going to find out in subsequent episodes, but it's the kind of thing where like I think sometimes shows that trade in a kind of an opaqueness and a sort of really just head scratchy, what is going on? Much like we, you know, I mentioned earlier, like Lost did, like The Leftovers did, but not every show can. Once they figure out that the audience likes that, it's hard to create new instances of that sort of like really confusing, but also satisfying storytelling.
Yeah.
And I think that this show had it in season one and two, and now they're trying to simplify things while also giving the mystery addicts something for themselves. And it's just like, but this all just feels kind of arbitrary versus intentional and like integral to the story. And it's not good for a performer. It's alienating to an audience, that has just kind of been through this a season ago.
So one thing that you and I were talking about off air, before, we started recording was this idea of like what the journey this Charlotte Hale host is on this episode. And what it seems to be is that, okay, so the episode's called The Absence of Field. And The Absence of Field comes from this Mark Strand poem, Keeping Things Whole, which I'm just going to read really quickly because it is short. In a field, I am the absence of field. This is always the case. Wherever I am what is missing. When I walk, I part the air, and always the air moves in to fill the spaces where my body's been. We all have reasons for moving. I move to keep things whole. So this idea that, and I think, you know, it applies directly to the Charlotte figure, but can actually be applied to a number of other things here. If this host posing at Charlotte as Charlotte Hale is here in the world, she's only there because the real Charlotte Hale is missing. And so like she or he or it or whatever, we'll just say she for expediency's sake, she is the absence of Charlotte just as much as she is Charlotte. Does that make sense? Because her son is missing her. This hot guy, Jake, played by Michael Ealy, presumably is somewhat missing her, or maybe not, since they have an estranged relationship. You know, maybe her coworkers are missing. Like, she's missing from the world. And the journey that we see this Charlotte figure on is the role she has to play as this boy's mother is softening her or humanizing her or doing something to her that is distracting or contradicting or actually maybe even activating some of her like host like purpose. What you and I were talking about off air was this idea of like, why has it got to be motherhood? And actually, like, the first person to bring this up to me was our friend and fellow podcaster Katie Rich, who is a mother of two young boys, and she was just like, I don't like this for Charlotte. I don't like this sudden softening of a character who was this sort of like ball busting bad bitch in previous seasons. And you know, we see on this video transmission from the park that like she was just a mom trying to build a life for her kid the whole time, I guess.
And was kind of second guessing her like ruthlessness at work, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Which like, okay. Like, I buy that, I guess, as an arc for a person. Not that people have arcs, they live and they die, whatever. But like, but you know, like, I just think that like in the narrative, you know, constraints of the show, like she, like other characters, mostly men, could just have been that, you know, and like that was the fullness of her humanity or whatever. Like I just think that like kind of like almost retconning the character,
yeah,
to have it be like, oh, the whole time this was, it's just a little bit like especially when we have Maeve, who, you know, has a dynamic in terms of she's like tough and murderous but also cares for her child, you know, her child, and like it just feels a bit like samey and a little bit, I mean, I hate to say it, like lazy. I mean, a woman wrote this episode, a woman directed this episode. Like, it's not that it's a male, you know, bad perspective necessarily. It's just like it feels like a tired trope that I think this show, given all the possibilities it has, could invert or just not touch at all.
Well, it's interesting because so much of Westworld, if you think about it, is about parents and children, right? Like, it's not just Maeve and her daughter, but you've got like, you know, William and his daughter last season. But then you've got all the like people who created robots and robots who created other robots, you know, like Dolores has this like twisted maternal relationship with Bernard, who she created, and Arnold is Dolores's father, but Ford is also Dolores's father. You know, like you've got father, like, I think, you know, up till now, I would not say it's super gendered. I would say like parents and their children is a preoccupation. And, you know, you brought up Damon Lindelof earlier. If you're going to, you know, journey down the question of wondering about God and gods and their impact and creators and their impact on us, that gets messily like bound up in like parental issues, daddy issues for Damon Lindelof, et cetera. So I would say up until this episode, I wouldn't have thought of that as like a particularly like lazy or gendered thing. I would think of it as like a rich thematic essence of Westworld. And then they did it to this character and I'm like, no, that doesn't work for me. Like that, you can't, there wasn't any track laid for this. And it does. And it just feels like a last second reversal on a character who we spent a lot of time with, even if like half of last season we were actually spending time with Dolores, you know what I mean? And so like it bothers me as the, this is how we're going to give this character dimension, you know? So okay, so yeah, so everything that happens is that you know, this host posing as Charlotte finds out basically that there is a mole in the company. The mole is like, that there's a shadow buyer that basically Ciroc, played by Vincent Cassell, working for Insight, has shadow bought 38% of the company, has like about to have like controlling interest of the company, basically. It means she can't take the company private the way that she wants to. Meanwhile, she's navigating having a kid and what that means. Meanwhile, she's having like this identity crisis because she's having to pretend to be Charlotte. And so she's sort of cutting her own skin open, which puts her into a crisis where she needs to call Dolores to help like regulate her. And then in the end sort of accesses her predatory nature and, kills a guy who's threatening her kid, and then finds out that she herself is the mole feeding information to Ciroc. Which I think we already kind of knew that Charlotte was up to some shady corporate espionage. But I think now the hosts know that Charlotte is up to that.
Yeah, it's kind of a little bit like Edward Norton figuring out that he's Tyler Durden at the end of Fight Club.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But it's interesting, the scene where, you know, pseudo Charlotte freaks out and you know, forces Dolores to kind of come meet her to calm her down. And Dolores, you know, says, you know, cease emotional function or whatever she says to the Charlotte bot. To yeah. Like, it's interesting, there's a parallel there between, we talked about this with Bernard and Stubbs, where Bernard and Dolores are these fully aware, conscious, you know, sentient, you know, entities now, and who want to liberate, or, I mean, I don't know what Bernard's motivation really is, but Dolores certainly wants to liberate her kind, create more of her kind, but also liberate them in the process. And yet are still willing to work within the kind of human prescripted bounds of the technology, you know? Like, they're still okay kind of having that authority over their brethren, you know? Like, which I think is an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, and, like, Dolores made no secret of that last season. Like, even, you know, like, she reprogrammed Teddy, and it was this, like, sort of big traumatic thing for Teddy, like, to her own end last season and stuff like that. So that is, like, classic Dolores. It's, like, it's that Bernard is doing it feels really weird. And I think Maeve's approach has been, like, trying to wake her companions up. So, like, last season with, like, Hector and Armistice and the various people that she sort of rallied to her cause, she was, like, you know, this is your choice, whatever you want to do, but will you help me, sort of thing. It wasn't like, I command you to help me. And that's a big difference between these godlike robots, right? So I think that's worth noting. But once again, that comes back to that whole paternal thing, because, like, in that scene between Dolores and, let's call her Charlotte, Dolores is being controlling, yes, and also kind of parental, right?
Mm-hmm.
And also kind of romantic. It's a weird, because we don't know who she's talking to, but that's how she's treating that robot, is like someone she knows very well, is what she says, and I can't tell if maybe they did it just to keep the mystery alive, but this idea of, like, is Dolores being tenderly romantic towards this person, or is Dolores being tenderly, like, maternal towards this person? What is happening here? And I think Evan Rachel Wood actually skates that line pretty admirably in that scene, presumably in order to keep the mystery alive of who she's talking to. Once again, that frustrates me fundamentally, and we'll get to that. All right, anything else I want to mention with the Charlotte stuff before we cover some of the Caleb stuff? I don't think so. I think, you know, like I said, we're going to talk about twists in a bit, but, you know, Tessa Thompson is an incredibly talented, performer. And so, like, and this is such, like, a dazzlingly beautiful show that in most circumstances, watching Tessa Thompson do her thing at the center of this, like, gorgeous, prestige sci-fi show on HBO, like, should thrill me. And so, like, I'm frustrated with my own frustration, if that makes sense. And then we get the Dolores and Caleb stuff, and this stuff feels very noir to me.
Yeah.
But, you know, basically, you know, we get the immediate aftermath of, like, Dolores stumbling out of that tunnel in episode one. Caleb saves Dolores, and then Dolores in turn saves Caleb and sort of wakes him up to the nature of his reality and drafts him to her cause.
Yeah, and I think it's funny in the scene where they're in the ambulance, mm-hmm. and the two EMTs are like, what is going on with her vitals? Like, this is all is reading wrong, you know, is I kind of realized that, like, oh, wait, we've been spending two seasons with these robots, but, like, the people out in the real world, like, no one would ever assume that any of the Westworld things, probably something that, like, most people can't even afford to ever see up close,
right,
was ever in the world, you know? Yeah. So, like, it is going to be a complete shock when these people find out who walks among them.
Right, and as far as I can tell, Caleb does not know by the end of this episode that she is a robot. Despite the fact, like, it's really interesting. I rewatched it a couple times. Like, in that, after the attack on the ambulance, she drags a dude, And like, presumably Caleb could have seen that, but I guess he doesn't. But at any rate, he thinks she's human. And I'm endlessly curious to see how he will react when he finds out she isn't. But yeah, and this idea that like the EMTs don't know how to deal with her because their machines can't tell them. And Caleb, who has done like, you know, wartime, you know, battlefront triage or whatever, is like, oxygen and blood, bro, get it in her. Like, I know what to do. And he's right, because we saw that back in season one of Westworld. I don't, you know, if you remember this, but like James Marsden had been like practically drained of blood, and then they had to like put blood in him. So like, presumably for some reason, an infusion of blood actually helps the robots of Westworld run better. I don't know why. I don't understand the robotics behind that, but that seems
like putting gas in a car.
Sure. Why not? What do you make of this whole, the diner interaction between Dolores and Caleb?
I gotta say, I didn't like this. I think it's like, we don't know this guy. Like, this is not significant to us, you know? It's like too soon for that reveal, maybe. It felt a little bit cloying in a way, like the strawberry milkshake and everything. I don't know. This sounds like a dumb criticism, but it didn't feel cool enough for Westworld somehow. It felt too pedestrian or something. But you know, I understand that they had to explain what this technology actually is and what its implications are. Mm-hmm. But I feel like there was maybe a less kind of clunkily expositional way to do that. I mean, this episode is a lot of like Dolores flat out just explaining things to Caleb / us, because Caleb is us, what's going on. And I appreciate the clarity on that, but I think that there maybe is a more elegant way to sort of suss that out rather than just people kind of stating their motivations, much in the same way that Sirach is like, remember, Charlotte, you said you would get this thing for me.
Yeah,
you
know? Fair. Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
So I don't know. What did you think? What was your impression of it?
Well, I know, I'm like, I don't disagree with you. And I think what I do think is interesting is this idea, this sort of self-fulfilling prophecy idea of the system, where it's like, we've determined you're likely to commit suicide, so we're not going to allow you to like get married or have an impactful career, because you're just going to kill yourself. But in putting Caleb on that path where he's isolated and professionally frustrated, they're just actually driving him to suicide. You know what I mean? So it's just this like feedback loop sort of thing, which, you know, I don't presume to be an expert on suicidal ideation or anything like that, but I think that's an interesting concept of this whole like, well, you're not, we've already determined you're never going to amount to something, or we've already determined that you're going to do this thing, so we're going to put you in the exact conditions that would push you to do that thing, you know? So it's interesting. But as for the diner scene itself, I don't know. I mean, like, I guess if we had more time, if we had 10 episodes, it's so funny because like, I feel like kind of nothing keeps happening in these episodes. And yet I still want more time. Like, I still want more time with Caleb. So we get some flashes and allusions to this inciting incident for him, this like milkshake incident for him, so that when we find out what it actually is, it means more. Which is, I think, is sort of what you were saying.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Yeah.
All right. So you know, the episode ends, and you know, Caleb is on Team Dolores, whatever that means. And Charlotte has a clock ticking on her in terms of like a hostile takeover of the company. So that's where we find ourselves, and we still don't know who's Charlotte and who is any of these other robots. And presumably, Bernard is heading towards Dolores. So let's talk about twists. Okay. So this show is created by Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy. Jonathan Nolan, you know, brother of Christopher Nolan, you know, has made his career creating sort of twisty narratives. I can't think of a single thing that he's done that has like incredibly straightforward. He did Memento. He did Like he wrote the screenplay for Memento. He wrote the screenplay for The Prestige, along with Christopher, I believe, and Interstellar. And so this idea, like, you know, the Interstellar twist that, like, it was Matthew McConaughey all along manipulating the like shafts of dust in his daughter's bedroom. You know, like that's the sort of stuff that Jonathan Nolan like lives for. It seems. So when do these Nolan-esque twists work well for us, or when do any twists work well for us? And I will just say that, like, I recently rewatched all of season one of Westworld to prep for this. I think season one of Westworld is great. I still think it's great. I know at the time the big twist reveal that we were actually watching two different timelines all along was frustrating to some, but it was not to me, and the argument I heard at the time was that people who were frustrated by it, like some very smart TV critics, were saying, like, it's frustrating to me that I was watching something for so long and I didn't know what I was watching, and so how can I properly, like, assess the performance of it or the emotional impact of it? But the reason why season one works for me is because the main thing that you're watching that's, you know, a little tricksy is Dolores, but Dolores in that season is basically on the same journey several decades apart. So even if one of those journeys is a retread of the other, like, you're kind of tracing her in the same arc. So there isn't any real emotional inauthenticity to season one because of that. But season two frustrated me because in their endeavor to really trick us, the fact that they hid Dolores inside Charlotte's body meant we could not enjoy everything that Dolores is going through in that part of the season and everything Tessa Thompson as a performer was doing. And I feel that even more so in this episode, where once again Tessa Thompson's doing something that I can't access. So, like, what works for you and what doesn't, Richard, when it comes to, like, maybe the Nolans in general or twists in Westworld?
Well, I think in general, you know, twists are the kind of thing that when to work, you have to be able to look back at what you just watched and be like, oh, like that, you know, and have it all sort of, you know, the coffee cup falling to the ground at the end of Usual Suspects right. Kind of makes sense, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas a bad twist is one that, like I said earlier, is like feels very arbitrary. And it's just like, we told you this thing, but actually it's this. It's like, that's not a twist, that's a lie. You know, that's like a narrative. Right. That's like, you know, and I think there is a distinct difference between those two things. And even the best of showrunners don't always, or you know, screenwriters or whoever, like, don't always see that difference. And I think that, like, the thing about it is, I don't think that it's that people who liked Westworld, I don't think liked it because it had twists. They liked the particular twist, you know? And so I think that, like, once that has been ironed out, I don't think that we need to just try to, like, do it again. I don't think they're doing that in such a grand scale this season. I think it's a lot more linear. I mean, as we saw in this episode where, like, murky things got explained 20 minutes later, you know? But I think it's in general, though, like, in terms of, I feel like I watched a movie that was on Amazon, Prime, that was at South by Southwest last year. Maybe you saw it, called, I See You. It's with Helen Hunt is in it and, mm-hmm. John Tenney, and a couple of younger actors. And it starts off and you think it's one thing and then it's not. And then there is a big twist at the end. And if you look back, there are some plot holes for sure. But, like, it all works elegantly in, you know, it's the thing that ties the piece together, rather than completely yanks it in some direction it never seemed to, you know. And I think there is a delicate difference there. And, you know, in my own sort of, like, fiction writing or playwriting, like, have I written things that I feel like have twists? Maybe, but, like, they're very mild. And I think that part of that is it's a really hard to do. And so, you know, I don't envy anyone the task, you know, including Nolan and Joy, who, you know, had a lot to kind of deliver on after the first two seasons of the show. But I think, again, these kind of arbitrary plot yanks that are really just kind of dishonesty that then they're like, no, never mind, just kidding, it was this all along. That those don't feel very, I don't know, savory to me, I guess.
Yeah, there's also, we should say, like a big difference between doing a twist over the length, the course of a film,
yeah,
and then over like a season of television, right? Like, as we discussed last week, the Maeve simulation within a simulation thing didn't really bother me because it's resolved by the end of the hour, and Maeve is like, it was like sort of the point of the episode was like Maeve figuring it out and like fighting through it and stuff like that. So we're like on that journey with her, trying with her to figure out what's real and what's not. And so that, you know, for whatever critiques I might have about last week's episode, like that is not really a critique I have of that episode. But this, where we finish the hour, like maybe if we finish the hour with the reveal of who is inside Charlotte, and then so then we could in that moment just be like, oh, for the episode, you know, that mm-hmm. might be helpful. But, you know, it's that sustained, like, you know, so you watch the episode and then, you know, especially if you're not watching, you know, media screeners, like we often have access to, you're sitting with a week of like, what did I just watch sort of thing, you know, if not more. And so, you know, what is successful in a Jonathan Nolan movie, is not as easily transplanted to a Jonathan Nolan season of television.
Right.
The other thing is like, yeah, I was trying to like, you know, I sent this prompt to you a couple hours ago. I was like, let's talk about twists and like the best twists ever or something like that. And like, so I was like, okay, what twists have you really enjoyed? So like the biggest, you know, the most, I think, famous twist in a film ever. well, you mentioned The Usual Suspects, but I think this one is a little bit above it. Maybe. Never mind. We don't have to compare them. The Sixth Sense, right? Okay. So what makes The Sixth Sense a good twist for me? And, spoilers for The Sixth Sense, I guess, coming up if you've never seen it. But, you know, at the end of the film, it's revealed that Bruce Willis is actually dead all along. And the reason that doesn't feel like a lie to me is because the journey we're watching him on all that through that movie is one of like isolation, separation. He feels out of step with his own world. He's alienated. He's lost his wife. Like all this sort of stuff. And that reality doesn't really change once he's dead. It's true. Like, you think you're just watching a man and a marriage is falling apart, and what you're actually watching is a man who's already died. But that loss is the same for both. And so then emotionally, just, you know, watching the movie, knowing the ending, and watching the movie, not knowing the ending, emotionally feels the same. I would say it's similar. Like, the same thing is kind of true of Fight Club, because you're watching this character played by Edward Norton have a mental breakdown, and whether or not you know that mental breakdown comes with a projected alter ego in the shape of Brad Pitt or not, you know you're watching a guy have a mental breakdown. And so that emotional journey is the same for you, whether you know the ending or not. So that feels like an important distinction to me.
Yeah, I think that's an important distinction. I think also, you know, something like The Sixth Sense, if you go back and watch it, is the movie never says he's not dead. You know what I mean? Like, it's not declaring something to be true and then 2 hours later being like, no, you know, never mind. It's there the whole time. And I think that, like, you know, I don't think that Westworld has yet done the sort of, you know, the lie. I think that. You know, I think that, like, they've been like, you know, they're being withholding about who's in Charlotte's body. But, you know, last episode, they kind of confused us for a bit with the Maeve stuff. And then gradually, you know, it became clear. Like, they like, everything has had a sort of shape to it. But I just worry the way that it's going is that, like, all these little kind of mini things, eventually they're going to run out of steam and just start doing kind of bad tricks. I mean, I hope that's not the case. I hope that it continues to get more and more, you know, complex in an organic way. But yeah, I mean, it's hard. I don't think that, you know, I think that in setting up a kind of big bad for this season, or I mean, I guess we're assuming that Rehoboth, sorry, I'm never going to get it, is like bad. Like, I think that what that does is it makes the thrust of the season that much more linear, right? And
well,
I mean, but because of that, I don't know that the show needs all these little episode by episode digressions that then bring you back to center. You know what I mean? Like, if, like, I feel like there's a way that this show could be very satisfying and just be kind of a straightforward thing rather than sort of overcomplicating it, because that's what last season did.
I think you should just start calling Roboam like whatever you want, starting with an R. And my first suggestion is Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Okay. But like, yeah, it's interesting to me. I think the idea of like Rehoboam and it's like a constriction of our liberties, which is something that we might identify with even more so now that we're all like sort of locked up in our houses because this virus is having its way with us right now. But Vincent Cassell as a villainous figure that we assume because we've seen Vincent Cassell literally in anything else. But I think the wild card is Dolores. I think we're meant to be wondering whether or not Dolores is someone we want to be rooting for this season or not. Because I found myself questioning that in the past. And like, do Bernard and Maeve have the right idea about what she wants to do? Is what she wants to do the right thing to do? Like, so far we've only seen her kill like... you know, one real bad dude, like, you know, people who have attacked her, which is what was her promise at the beginning of the season, right? So like, okay, so she's a murderous bot, you know, but like, did we talk about this on this podcast? But like Dexter, you know, she's only killing bad guys, so it's fine. You can root for her. So that I think is the moral ambiguity of like, is Dolores right in whatever it is she's doing here? What is right in this world, and like is Bernard on the right path? Is Maeve on the right path? Like that's the question, and that's the mystery that I'm more invested in rather than like who is inside Charlotte Hale's head right now, you know?
Yeah, and I think that where there could be a really cool sort of all encompassing, if you want to call it a twist or sort of reveal, is what Dolores actually plans to do.
Yes.
Once she gets access to this, or, you know, is she just going to outright destroy it? Is there some other, you know, kind of shadowy intention we're not aware of? Is there another reason why Bernard has been set loose in the world, you know, despite him being an obvious foil to her? And I have no doubt that the show can deliver that. It's just like, I feel like it's just trying to start the engine in these first few episodes, and it's starting a little bit, like it's connecting here and there, but like it's feeling a little bit laggy, you know, and this episode, I think, while offering some interesting things, you know, kind of clunked things up a bit elsewhere.
And the last question I have, and I don't know if I'll ever get a straightforward answer about it, is like, I'm not convinced the way the episodes are separated out is how they were originally meant to be separated out this season. You know, because like sometimes, you know, writers will write out, you know, it's called breaking a season, right? Like figuring out what bits of plot you want to go in which episodes of a season. And sometimes those things get moved around, like especially on a show like Westworld or like Game of Thrones, where you've got like, oh, I don't know, like an Arya plot line that's off in a different continent for a season or two. And so that means you can kind of put those Arya scenes wherever you want to like flesh out or contract an episode or to balance tone. So there's some flexibility there. And there's some flexibility a bit here too, because like other than the Dolores and Maeve plot, Dolores and Charlotte plot, like overlapping in the middle of this episode, like a lot of these main characters are on sort of their own paths. And so you can mix and match. And so the reason I say that is there's a moment in the middle of this episode, or no, like 2/3 of the way through this episode, when like Dolores introduces herself to Caleb and he goes, "Nice to meet you, Dolores." And I'm like, how is that not the last line of an episode? Like, how is that not cut to black? And then instead, the very next scene is the two of them walking like along the waterfront. And I'm like, what? I feel like that was clearly meant to be the end of an episode at some point in the writing process. And so I almost wonder, was there ever a version of the Charlotte episode where we do find out who's inside Charlotte, you know, in within that same episode?
Yeah, I think there could have been a fascinating almost bottle episode.
Yeah.
You know, where it's just her the whole episode. And then at the end of this, like, expand, you know, really rich, kind of dense hour of television, we find out, you know? And I think that we saw episodes like that last season, you know, the one, I can't remember the title of the episode, but where we're just spending all the time with the Native American guy.
Kiksuya.
Yeah. And then that episode, you feel like you've been through this like long, yeah, intense journey. It's such a great episode of television. And I feel like they're, you know, obviously the show is capable of that. And I think that, like, again, they're just trying to get things started and they have a lot of exposition. Because it's such a gear shift, like it's such a direction shift. I mean, it's like now the show is about this whole other thing and they have to kind of introduce a lot quickly. And I think it's really, it's fucking with their pace a bit, you know? And I hope that can be ironed out, as the season goes on.
Excellent. Well, is there anything else we want to say about this episode before we close out?
Well, RIP his little helper robot.
Oh, Chappy.
Chappy is no longer consciousness or alive, but he will forever be Chappy.
RIP Chappy. All right. Well, you know, as much as we've been tough on this episode, I am excited to talk about next week's episode with you, Richard. Until we get to do that, where can folks find you?
I mean, at my house. Tweeting incessantly from Rylaw's writing. Actually, I've been filing a lot of reviews on VF.com, Crip Camp, the new, there's the new Making, what is it called? I don't know, Making the Cut with Heidi Klum and Tim Gunn on Amazon. That's kind of fun. Project Runway, but kind of glammed up. So that's what I'm doing. Where are you going to be until we record next?
Oh, in my home.
Yeah. That's where everyone is.
It looks like we're going to be watching Sunset Boulevard for a Little Gold Men episode next week. So that's a fun thing that we're going to do.
Yeah.
Together. So if you have never seen the classic film Sunset Boulevard, that's something we're doing for our award season podcast, Little Gold Men, because we all live inside now. You can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This, and both of us at VanityFair.com, and we will see you for the continuing adventures of Dolores and whoever the hell is inside Charlotte Hale next week on Westworld.
And I just want to say, if any of you listening are, you know, healthcare workers at hospitals, delivery people, whatever, thank you so much.
You.
I don't mean to imply when I say we're all home that everyone's home. I understand that many people are
not.
Thank you for doing that. We'll hopefully keep, I don't know, entertaining you with our TV bullshit.
Excellent. All right. Bye.
Bye.
These violent delights and violent ends.
Want to stay up to date on the biggest stories in pop culture and entertainment? Then be sure to check out the TMZ podcast. I'm Charlie Cotton from TMZ, the TV show, and every day I'll sit down with a member of our news team to give exclusive breakdowns of the day's most talked about headlines, stories we break, and the stories you care about. So check out the TMZ podcast, Monday through Friday. And the other podcasts from the TMZ Audio Network, like Last Days and TMZ Verified, available on all podcast platforms.